Is your child defiant, independent, annoyingly inquisitive? After a long, hard day of following the rules, who wants to deal with troublesome kids? 49% of children suffer from oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Symptoms of ODD include independent thought, rampant creativity, and failure to submit to authority. But now there's a solution. The good people at Pilfer can help you with their time-release, once-daily capsule, Compliacin. Your child won't be able to form his own opinions, let alone express them. It maintains your child's ability to go to a state-run school and perform simple tasks around the house. You won't have to worry about parenting, and the school won't have to deal with your kid asking questions. Compliacin. You'll go from this.
Quit telling me what to do!
To this.
Good morning, Mother. I love going to school. And this week we're learning all about how the government is our federal family and they're here to help us.
Compliacin. Talk to your school psychiatrist and ask for it by name.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on the Seize Liberty podcast and theconsciousresistance.com. So today I'm delighted to have returning guest with me, Mary Ruart, coming in from Texas. She is an amazingly energetic woman that hopefully will inspire you as she inspires me. You can find her work on ruart.com. She just recently released her recent book called Death by Regulation, How We Were Robbed of a Golden Age of Health and How We Can Reclaim It. And it's been in the bestseller list for a few days, so that's awesome. You can find her contact information on through her website, but she's also on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. So yeah, we're just going to discuss the book, what it's all about, and get into a little bit of the fun, murky waters of government regulation. So, Mary, thanks a lot for coming back on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. And I'm excited about the new book because what it shows is that the 1962 amendments to the Food and Drug Act have actually cost each of us about 5 to 10 years of our lives. And it doesn't matter if we're a regulator, a pharmaceutical executive, a congressional rep, we're all affected. And while that is very sad, the other aspect of that is because we're all affected, maybe we can change this. So I'm excited.
Oh, yeah, I definitely hope so. And you know, what I just thought of was, I don't know if the politicians are, you know, it's hard to say if they're just incompetent or they're downright wicked in that they know what the regulations do. It's kind of hard to say. Regardless, the regulations do have their effect. And also, it's very sad when you see politicians and their family members get some kind of an illness that perhaps would be most easily solved, you know, with a medication, with an herb, or whatever, that was able to be, developed and researched. Mm-hmm. If these regulations were not there. So it's not even hurting just us. It's hurting everybody.
Well, that's right. That's right. And that's why I have hope that maybe we can change this. In fact, there was an FDA regulator who was in charge of the cancer division, and he kept demanding more and more studies. So the approval got delayed and delayed and delayed. And when his wife got sick and he found out how hard it was to get her experimental treatment, he changed his mind about how to do things. Unfortunately, his wife died. That's the bad news. The good news is he said, well, from now on, I'm going to try to get these approvals through faster. So instead of demanding more and more studies, he cut the approval time, the part that was under his control, from 6 months to 5 months. And that will save some lives. But the problem is these 1962 amendments to the Food and Drug Act took the time that it takes for a new drug to get from the lab bench to the marketplace from 4 to 14 years. Mm-hmm. So obviously the small time that this particular FDA regulator, he had the final segment, you know, so he could only look over this 14, well, it's actually closer to 13 now, 13 years of data and, decrease his contribution. So that was better than nothing. But we really need to get back to this 4-year mark or less. We could do it, but the regulations increase every year because these amendments were open-ended. So they've kind of metastasized every year. So the bad news is, even though the timeline has been stable for a while in 13 years, the cost of bringing a drug to market has increased exponentially. And that's bad because the cost of research and development for a new drug is directly correlated with the prices that we pay at the pharmacy. In other words, it's not greedy drug companies that are driving the price up. It is literally these regulations which metastasize and increase every year. And very few people outside of the industry really understand that.
You know, it's interesting that you use the word metastasize. I think it's very, very curious and very apropos word to use, because what initially got me down the path to voluntarism and free market capitalism was learning about the cancer industry and how, you know, the FDA stifles alternative treatments to cancer, and like how it only allows you know, the three major treatments, right? Chemo, surgery, and radiation. And everything else, it vilifies, censors, and just destroys. And how I remember learning about all these different types of therapies, which seem to be helping, yet almost every single time, the founder or the person who was actually helping people to live longer and healthy lives, somehow, oftentimes mysteriously, you know, their clinic burns down, their documents are destroyed, they die in a strange, you know, accident, and it's so sad to hear that. And I remember reading one study about how, you know, when you're diagnosed with cancer, until your death, you're worth like $300,000 to the cancer industry, you know, and yeah. So it's very sad to me, and I see it a lot, like and how, you know, when you see a person going through all those you know, those therapies, and at one point it looks like the cancer has gone into remission and things are better, but then it comes back with a vengeance. And it's like, so, and then I don't know if you're familiar with some of these therapies, like the Gerson therapy.
Yes.
You are? Okay, cool. Yes.
I'm very familiar because there's a lot of cancer in my family. In fact, my sister Marty went to Mexico to get the Gerson therapy.
Oh, wow. Yes. Yeah. I learned about that. I saw, you know, documentaries. I got her book, Charlotte Gerson. Learned about fascinating. And, yeah, and I tell this to people. I'm like, yeah, it's illegal for them to practice here. And so they go to Mexico, and people with cancer who already get a death sentence from their oncologist, they're like, you know, they're like, go home, you know, arrange all your belongings, you know, fix your affairs, you know, prepare to die. And they're like, no, I don't want to die, and there must be a solution. And so they oftentimes seek out alternative therapies like that. They go to Mexico,
right.
and miraculous, miraculous recovery. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's because of that long timeline, too, this 13 to 14-year timeline, that, you know, cancer patients sued the FDA for the right to take unapproved drugs. And they said it was their constitutional right to do so in order, you know, health and welfare and everything. And the courts ruled that, no, they don't have a constitutional right to save their lives with unapproved drugs. And that's why Right to Try is now in Congress, because Right to Try is basically that same lawsuit, except it was done state by state and now is in the Congress.
Yeah. Right to Try. Definitely. Exactly. I mean, it's like these people are already on their deathbed. It's like, I mean, to me, it's kind of similar to the idea of like swabbing a you know, the area before they deliver the needle, you know, to kill the patient. You know, it's just like, we don't want you to get that last-minute infection, right? So,
yeah.
It's kind of like that. It's like they already have nothing else to lose, so and you're robbing them of their ability to, you know, try whatever they can get their hands on. And,
well, that's right. Yeah, when we were doing the initial research for AIDS drugs, the AIDS patients knew they couldn't, you know, wait for drugs to get through. So they actually hired black market chemists to make the very drugs we were working on. And by the time the FDA gave the drug companies permission to just test the drugs in people. Right. Every AIDS patient in the country who wanted them had already had them and was resistant. So we had to wait until new people were diagnosed with AIDS to do the tests that the FDA required. I mean, this, you know, people who are dying shouldn't have to do that. And if you saw the movie Dallas Buyers Club, you saw that the FDA actually prosecuted and persecuted some of these buyers clubs that were distributing nutritional supplements, drugs from overseas, and also drugs that the black market chemists were making on demand, so to speak, because they knew we weren't going to be able to get through the FDA in time to save their lives.
Yeah, it's almost, you know, it's almost like if something is banned, you know, by the federal government, you got to wonder, like, is this healthy? This must be really healthy for me if the federal government doesn't want me to have it.
Well, I think most of the people at the FDA that I worked with, you know, they're well-meaning. Yeah. And some of them recognize that when you delay a drug's approval, people die. Mm. I mean, they get that. Unfortunately, the way these amendments are constructed, it really puts the FDA between a rock and a hard place, because it used to be, before the amendments, that we'd get all of our data together, we'd send it to the FDA, and if they didn't object in 6 months, then we could market. But the amendments made somebody in the FDA sign on the dotted line and saying, I recommend this approval. And once that happened, of course, if there were side effects, and every drug has side effects, so it was just a matter of time before some side effect came to the attention of the American public and then came to the attention of Congress. And then Congress would beat up on the FDA and say, why did you approve this unsafe drug? Well, you know, every drug is unsafe for some people. It's just if they're powerful enough to heal you from a dread disease, they're powerful enough to cause side effects in some people. It's just the way it is. So very sad.
Yeah. That is a good point that, you know, these drugs, they have the ability to heal, but that doesn't mean that they can't harm you. And I'm a Chinese herbalist, right, and acupuncturist, and one of the common fallacies is that, oh, it's herbs. Herbs are safe, you know, because it's natural. Whereas, no. Some herbs are very strong, very powerful, and in the hands of an incompetent herbalist can do harm. You know, so not just because it's like poison ivy, it's natural. You know, scorpion venom, it's natural.
Yeah. Or aflatoxin, it's natural.
Yeah.
I think it's the most potent carcinogen known, so.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a meme where you see the planet Earth, and you see a big giant asteroid coming, you know, smashing into the Earth, and it's like, don't worry, it's natural.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I love natural products, but just, you know, like you were saying, you've got to be careful with those too. You know, nothing is completely, quote, safe. You know, even water, it can kill us, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, there are risks. Yeah, there are risks to everything. I mean, living is a risk. It's risky.
That's
living.
Right. Yes.
But still. Go ahead.
I was going to say one of the little jokes that I have in my Healing Our World book is the FDA standing over the therapies that this person in a wheelchair wants and saying, these therapies won't be available before you die, but at least you'll die safe. This is the kind of philosophy that we have now. I mean, everyone who's objected to the right to try is saying, oh, yes, I mean, we're sympathetic with these poor terminally ill people, but if they take something that's not approved, it could kill them or it could make their last few days worse. Well, of course, there's always this risk. I mean, you know, I've had two members of my family die from the chemo. So the treatment can kill you. So, I mean, approved treatments can kill you. It's crazy to even think in those terms. If somebody wants to take the risk because they feel they have no other choice or their other choices aren't very good choices, then of course they should be able to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, drawing an analogy from another aspect, which is, child labor in factories, you know, from our perspective, that's horrible, that's gruesome, look at these children. But again, what's their alternative?
Yeah, you know, in developing countries, their alternative is to starve.
Yeah.
To prostitute themselves, which is a whole lot worse than working in a dirty factory.
Yeah, Yeah, and so same thing here. You know, when you give people the choices to, you know, to make to improve their lives the way they want, without, you know, giant nanny state coming in and suffocating them to death, wonderful things happen. You know, people live, people prosper. But the nanny state is something that you know, has been encroaching for many, many years, different regulations, different laws, trying to make people safe, whereas, you know, as we just said, life is risky, you know. We do homeschooling and unschooling, and I want my kids to be out in nature, where it's dangerous, you know. It's dangerous, you know, anything can happen. They're running in the woods, they can trip and fall. It's true, you know. What are you going to do? They get dirty. What are you going to do, you know?
That's right. Life isn't safe. I mean, that's just what it is. And we're much safer here in this country than in some other countries, you know, in terms of, you know, our standard of living is much higher. We can get medical treatment when we need it for the most part. And yet, I think there's not an appreciation about how lucky we are. You know, people don't, especially those that don't travel, haven't seen the people in developing countries and how much they suffer. So it's sad. It's sad. We don't have an appreciation of what they go through.
Yes, yes, definitely. It's amazing. There's so many things that we take for granted now in our modern day. You know, I was just listening to a podcast called How It Began, wonderful, wonderful history podcast, talking about, you know, various things and taking them apart, like, you know, electricity, how it began, refrigeration, how it began, computers, how they began, you know. So I was just listening with my son, 7-year-old son. We were listening to surgery. How did surgery develop the way it is? And for most of human history, if you got a wound, like, let's say, a compound fracture, and it pierced your skin, right, they could set the bone, right? Well, first of all, there's no anesthesia, so it's incredibly painful, right?
Yes.
Second of all, even if they do set the bone, most people, vast majority of people, die of infection.
That's right.
No antiseptics, no way to treat. They had no idea what it was, right? They they thought it was like, you know, like just mysterious bad air. They tried, you know, walls of fire. They tried open ventilation. They didn't know what to do.
That's right.
Mysterious
That's
infection. Right. And so, you know, just that, just developing antiseptic stuff to combat, you know, bacterial infection, microorganisms just infecting open wound, vast increase in mortality, morbidity, longevity, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. We've made a lot of strides in the last 100 years or so, but we have a long way to go too. I think most people don't realize we're just scratching the surface. And one of the reasons I wrote Death by Regulation and entitled it How We Were Robbed of a Golden Age of Health is because just before these amendments were passed, a lot of really wonderful things were happening. We had finally sequenced some DNA, so we knew it, and we knew it was the genetic material. We were able to manufacture large quantities of vitamins for the first time, you know, in our history, so that we could actually take supplements. And there were a lot of really wonderful things happening, but these amendments really stifled a lot of that. It really stifled the whole idea of preventative medicine, and it changed really how we deal with the genetics. You know, the FDA has really driven a lot of the important stem cell work offshore by claiming that if you take stem cells from a person, so like, for example, if I were sick and wanted to have my knee repaired without a lot of surgery, they could take bone marrow or adipose tissue. They could concentrate the stem cells. And as long as they inject it back into my knee the same day, it's okay. It's medical practice. But if they take those stem cells out of me and grow them up for a week, so I'll get much more of a bang for my buck, so to speak. Then these manipulated stem cells are considered to be a drug by the FDA.
Wow.
Then they have to go through all this rigmarole and, you know, all these regulations. And the way the regulations are handled with drugs are very different from what you would do with stem cells. You know, the people who are working with stem cells, you know, keep tweaking their protocols because they learn every time they do these what works better. But this has all stopped in the United States, at least for stem cells that are grown up outside your body for a while, and it's all moved offshore. And it's really sad because proper stem cell work can really replace a lot of surgeries. And this is a big deal for some people. You know, if they get a knee replacement or hip replacement or some other type of surgery, it's not as good as new. Mm. But with stem cells, it can be. So it's an advance that it's really, we've really lost one of the many medical practice advances that we've lost, and probably one of the bigger ones.
Yeah, you know, one thing that that I've changed my mind on is when I first started studying this, I was studying, you know, medication, Western, you know, allopathic medicine, and comparing that with you know, alternative medicine, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, and I used to think that, you know, Western medicine, you know, evil, right? Medication, a lot of side effects, you know, terrible, horrible, and now I slowly come to realize that no, it's a different way to treat, and also, like you said, the astronomical price of, you know, any kind of treatment, therapy, surgery, or medication is in large part due to these regulations, right?
That's right.
Would not necessarily be so without that, you know, that influence. And also the other thing is, you know, it's hard to imagine, like, Western allopathic medicine in a completely free market, what the price would be, or how, you know, how medications would be if they didn't have to go through years and years and years of all these studies. And, you know, it's hard to imagine. And it kind of slightly annoys me that I'm not able to experience what that medicine would look like without jumping, you know, through all that hoop and bureaucracy.
Yeah, well, it'd be about 20 to 40 fold cheaper. So, yeah, I mean, I actually do the calculation in my book, you know. And the thing is, if these regulations actually made drugs more safe or more effective, we might say, okay, well, we're willing to pay that price. But they don't, and that's the saddest part of it. So we've added all this time on to the development of drugs, and we've increased the cost, and yet the withdrawal rate is virtually the same. And by withdrawal rate, I mean, once a drug comes on the market and then something goes wrong and it's taken off the market, we would expect that the amendments would decrease the percentage of drugs that come off the market that way, but they don't. Before the amendments, about 2.5% of all the approved drugs were taken off the market for safety reasons. After the amendments, it was about 3.3%. In other words, it's going in just the opposite direction. Those numbers probably aren't different, but still, you can see that it's not going in the predicted direction, which would have been less or fewer withdrawals. And the other thing is, the amendments were supposed to make drugs more effective. But consumers have saved, maybe they've saved 10% from ineffective drugs. And so when you get a 20 to 40 fold increase and you're only saving 10%, obviously that's a pretty rotten deal. So, you know, that's another issue. These amendments aren't doing what we thought they would do or what they were intended to do. And if you think about it for a moment, most people think that making a law makes it so. But that's not necessarily true. And in fact, these regulations themselves can't be shown to be safe and effective. I think I've pretty much shown that they're unsafe and ineffective. And so the FDA flunks its own criteria that places on drugs.
Yeah, to me, you know, every time I think of a law, I like the Stefan Molyneux quote, which is a law is an opinion with a gun, right? And so, like you said, they're not, you know, laws or regulations do not encourage creativity, innovation, right? Imagination. You can't do that. You can't do that with coercion or violence, right? You can't force people to be innovative. That's not how it works. And really all it does is the exact opposite, which is stifle innovation and creativity, makes things worse, right? You know, just keeps us stagnant. And
Yes. And the studies show that. About half of our drugs that make it into human clinical trials drop out in the middle or late phase development for economic reasons, which means that the drug makers realize, hey, this drug is going to be a loser, so we're not putting any more money into it. And actually, a lot of manufacturers do that triage before the drug goes in development. I remember the FDA actually called me up one day and said, Dr. Ruart, we're really excited about this patent you filed for prostaglandins and liver disease because there's nothing for that type of liver disease. And we want you to know that we're going to be here for you and we're going to help your company get this drug to market. And of course, being young and naive, I believe them. And so what we found is that unfortunately, when you really develop something new, when you have something really new, you don't know what dose to give. You don't know how many times a day you have to give it. For a chronic disease like liver disease, you don't know how long you got to treat. And if you don't guess right on all these things before you do your first clinical study, and you don't have the statistical significance that the FDA requires, then you have to start over. And the problem with that is, because these are long studies, these effectiveness studies are very long, years. So if you have to go back and repeat them, by the time you get done, the drug's off patent and it goes generic the first day and you don't recover your costs. So the company I worked with said, we're not going to go there. It's too risky. And so there's a lot of drugs that could be saving lives that end up on the shelves in the laboratories of drug companies and never see the light of day. And so if we lose half of them in late phase development, I'm guessing the total loss is probably closer to 80% because companies have a good feeling about what they can and can't do, and they drop a lot of them before they even get started. So this is very sad. And if we lose innovation, we're really screwed because if you don't, if the drug isn't on the market, I don't care how much money you have. You can't buy it.
Right. Let me ask you a question that I think might be on the mind of some of the listeners, which is, let's say somebody says, Dr. Ruart, so I understand that the FDA is, harming these drug companies with these regulations and stifling their progress and preventing them from releasing and producing these drugs. So what's the alternative? How are they supposed to make sure these drugs are safe if the FDA doesn't force them to test them? You know, what would be your answer to that?
Well, see, that's a great question, and the answer is certification. And actually, it's not uncommon. Our electrical appliances, for example, are not regulated. They're certified.
Right.
What's the difference? Well, what happens is a manufacturer would come to UL, that little UL symbol that you see on your electrical appliances, that's a seal of approval. It's not a regulatory mark. So if a company comes to UL and says, hey, I want you to test my product, and if UL says, this isn't good enough for us to give you the seal of approval, but if you did this, this, and this, I think it would probably work better. So they kind of work together to make sure there's a product that is approvable. And the thing is, though, if you, as a consumer, feel you want to buy something without that UL seal, you can. There's no law that prevents you. So, you see, this is the best of both worlds. You can wait, if you're a cautious consumer, until you get a drug that's certified. And it used to be, for example, the American Medical Association used to certify. And a lot of other places did, too. And so you can wait if you want. But if you're terminally ill and you don't have a lot of options, you can still buy a drug before it gets the seal of approval. So that's the difference between certification and regulation. When you have regulation, you as a consumer, you have no choice. You cannot buy that. It's forbidden for the manufacturer to give it to you even to give it to you for free unless it's approved by the FDA or unless, there's some special circumstances where you can get it, but they're very difficult in order to get that. So certification is really the way to go. And in fact, what's interesting is one of the consumer groups that was part of this cancer suit against the FDA because the cancer patients wanted to use unapproved drugs if they were terminal. The Abigail Alliance, one of the consumers groups, has actually recommended that 40 different cancer drugs be approved by the FDA years before they were approved. And they all were eventually approved. So if a consumer's group can tell when a drug is effective and point to it years before it receives an official approval, it's pretty clear that a certifying agency staffed by scientists could probably do a pretty good job too.
Yes, and I think also, you know, I always find that question interesting. You know, without the government, how will we make sure, you know, anything is safe? How would food be safe? How would medications be safe? And just like, you said, you know, there are innate incentives in business to not kill your customer. Like,
yeah.
It's amazing that needs to be said, right?
Right. Well, and actually, before the FDA got these amendments in 1962, people and doctors, when doctors would prescribe a medication, they would pay attention to which company made it. Mm. And if you ruined your reputation as a company, you know, the doctors were very hesitant to prescribe. And so reputation was important, and companies would advertise, our product has never had this kind of a side effect, for example. And we don't see that today. Mm. Today, as far as the physician's concerned, if it's FDA approved, then it's fine. They'll prescribe it. And of course, that means that a manufacturer doesn't have any incentive to protect their reputation. They do protect it in the sense because they want their stock to be high. But as far as prescribing behavior by doctors, there isn't a lot of reputation protection going on by companies anymore. And that's a shame because that's another market pressure that helps them make sure they don't put bad drugs on the market.
Yeah. Reputation is king, you know, because, yeah, I mean, once you lose that, you lose trust and you lose, you know, consumer confidence, and that's it. How are you going to continue? You know, and like I remember growing up, my father, I assume this is still around, Consumer Reports, that's still around, right? Yeah,
yes.
I remember growing up, my father, he always had Consumer Reports magazines, and I never really kind of knew what it was until later I grew up, and I'm like, oh, it's like an independent agency,
yeah.
Right, to assess products.
That's right.
And yeah, that's just another awesome example of how do we know that these products are good quality, right? You need an outside party that that, you know, does not use guns. That you know, they have their own reputation that they want to uphold as being a high quality, you know, independent certification company, right? So they want to do good too. So it's like everybody has the incentive to provide top quality service. Wonderful.
Exactly. And actually, there's a consumers group that actually looks, it's Public Citizen. They have a newsletter called Best Pills, Worst Pills. They actually have accurately predicted half of the drugs that have been withdrawn from the marketplace.
Wow.
You know, and so, you know, again, if a if a consumer group can do that well, you have to believe that a scientific certifier would do very well. And part of the reason there's a problem is the FDA, because their neck is on the line, so to speak, and because Congress doesn't seem to appreciate that all drugs are going to have side effects. Mm. You just can't have a drug that doesn't.
Right.
So the FDA has gotten more and more hesitant to approve a drug without lots and lots and lots of studies. And that's why the timeline has grown so long and the cost is so high. And, you know, you can't blame them. They're trying to protect their jobs, you know, and everything. But for them, every approval is a risk. It's a risk. They'll lose their jobs. So, of course, they don't want to approve drugs unless they have a pretty good idea that it's going to be okay. And I remember one of the stories of one of the examiners when he got the information for human cloned insulin, he was very excited because before that, diabetics, especially type 1 diabetics, don't make any insulin at all. Mm. You have to take insulin that came from pigs. And after, you know, several years, of course, they'd have allergic reactions, right? And that could kill them. I mean, they were doomed because if they didn't take the insulin, they died. If they took it, they had an allergic reaction. So when human cloned insulin became available, this was a huge breakthrough. And the examiner, after 4 months of looking at the data, said, we need to approve this. And the supervisor said, no, we can't approve it, because if we approve it in 4 months instead of the average, which at that time I think was about 2 years, and something goes wrong, you know, we'll get in trouble. So there's this disincentive to bring things to the market quickly, which is really sad. And so, in other words, in a way, we've shifted the responsibility for safe drugs from the manufacturer to the FDA. And, of course, that's put the FDA in a position where they're not going to want to approve anything until lots and lots and lots of studies have been done. And you can hardly blame them.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like an example of an antiquated, outdated, decrepit government institution trying to justify its own existence. You know, it's like, it just can't. Like you said, they're afraid for their jobs. You know, so the next step is not approving anything. We can't approve anything because we can't be 100% sure that it's safe.
Well, in fact, that's kind of what's going to happen, because every year the FDA adds more and more studies onto what's required for development. Yeah. And it's because of this. And so, you know, it's going to get to a point, if we don't change it, that there won't be any new drugs on the market, because none of them will really be affordable. It won't, in other words, when I say affordable, the company will not recover its costs. Right now, the companies, somewhere between 2 and 3 out of 10 drugs recover their costs. So the industry is depending on blockbuster drugs to fund research. Mm. And because of that, the companies have merged quite a bit. So we're having a lot of companies that develop drugs have merged so much that there's a handful of big companies. Mm. And little biotechs are where most of the research is taking place now. They're taking the risk of discovery. And when they want to raise enough money to develop drugs, what they find is it's very difficult, because it's about $2.5 billion per new drug.
Whoa.
Only the giant companies can do that. So sure. A lot of the little companies end up licensing their drugs to big pharma, and of course they get very little return compared to what they would get if they were allowed to do the development. But the cost of development has gotten so high, and it increases every year. So you can see where this is going. Pretty soon the costs will be so high, companies won't develop any drugs at all.
Oh, that's a chilling future. My father, he used to work in Leatherly.
Oh, yes.
You know, familiar, okay. And he's a mechanic of the machines, and then it merged, I guess, when it became Wyeth Earst. And mm-hmm. then it merged again, and it became Pfizer. So exactly what you're saying.
Exactly. I was with Up John. We actually merged with another company, and then Pfizer bought the merged company. So.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a lot of inefficiency in the big corporations, as you might imagine, just because they're so huge, you know. So it's also inefficient in that sense. Before the 1962 amendments, the smaller companies produced a drug, it took them less personnel and less cost. But when the 62 amendments hit, there was so much change and so many more regulatory demands that they went out of business. And so what's happening, obviously, is we're driving companies to a place where they have to be big to develop these drugs, and they don't do as much discovery as they used to. When I was in the industry, about 50% of the discovery happened in the larger size companies. Today, it's about 5%. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a very big difference.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not only happening in the in the pharmaceutical industry, but you know, in the meat industry, right, in the agricultural industry, you see these mergers of larger and larger corporations, mm-hmm. and then you have, you know, like let's say Monsanto, right? So you know, like I started out vilifying and hating Monsanto, which you know, of course, they've done a lot of horrible things, but they're not, you know, they're not the root. Right? Why are they able to be so large, and why are they able to do what they do with immunity. Same thing with the drug companies, right? It's like if a drug, if you get harmed by a drug, can you sue the drug company? No.
Yes. Well, actually, you can, unless it's a vaccine. Because see, what happens is these, you know, vaccines are a biological product, right? So you expect allergic reactions. I mean, you know you're going to have side effects. Mm-hmm. And because there were side effects, there were lawsuits. And, you know, vaccines aren't easy because they are a biological product. So between the cost of development and then the liability, companies just stopped making vaccines for a while. And so, you know, there's this big panic. So I think there were like two vaccine companies left. And so Congress passed a law that the vaccine companies would no longer be liable, that instead there'd be sort of a tax, if you will, on the vaccines. And this would go into a big fund, and then people who were harmed would get money from this fund. In other words, all of a sudden, the drug companies weren't liable. And so all of a sudden, vaccines proliferated. Now we are giving our children about somewhere between 2 and 3 dozen vaccines the first 7 years of life. I don't even know if an adult could take that. And here we've got immature immune systems having vaccines for things that we really don't see anymore and aren't likely to run into. And I think it's causing some real harm in our children.
Have you seen the documentary Vaxxed?
Yes, I've seen part of it. I don't think I'm not sure I've seen the whole thing, but I have seen part of it.
Yeah, I just saw it recently, and yeah, pretty amazing. I mean, I've known I know a couple of families that have been directly affected by vaccines and with autistic kids and everything, and then, you know, a lot of them say similar stories, like that they go to the doctor and the doctor's like, no, it's a coincidence, you know, he was going to get it anyway, you know. But, you know, as a parent, you know your child intimately, you know, you see the milestones, you pay attention to every little bit of progress, mm-hmm. and then when you see a sharp deviation in that progress, it's undeniable, you know.
Yes.
There's no question, and you're like, what did I do wrong, what did I do different? And you know, very often it's either the MMR or the DTaP ones. It seems like that they're the real big ones, but yeah, so it's really a fearful thing. And when I had kids, I used to look at that. I did a lot of reading in that, and I said, you know, I'm not going to give my kids vaccines. But the reason was because the ingredients and the effects of it, and they don't test, you know, single ingredients in infant children with immature immune systems. So how are they going to know that all this combination of all these different ingredients? So I'm like, forget it. I'm not even. But now I have the same stance, but I don't use it from that perspective. I go basically from the medical choice perspective. Mm-hmm. Like I want to have the choice.
Exactly. Well, sure you do. Sure. Like I said, I mean, just you don't have to be a scientist to recognize that if you're giving your child 24 to 36 vaccinations before they're 7 or 8, it's going to be an issue. This is a biological substance. You know, and it's not coming. It's not like a stem cell where you take it out of your own body. You know,
yeah.
It's coming from somewhere else, and biological products have problems. You know, they just are going to have more reactions. Some children are going to have some type of allergy reaction or other type of reaction. And so I think, again, vaccines can be very helpful in certain situations. But, you know, another thing that happens is not all people respond the same way.
Right.
So in other
right.
words, a lot of these outbreaks that we're seeing are not from unvaccinated children, but from vaccinated children, because
right.
their immune system isn't reacting
right.
To give them that immunity. And when, you know, when I was a child, we got deliberately exposed to measles and mumps so that we would, especially girl children, because you didn't want to be pregnant and an adult when you got those things, because that hurt
right.
the fetus, right?
So right.
you wanted to be exposed when you were a child. And I'm sure there were some deaths from that, but few compared to, you know, a lot of the problems that we have today. So it's really, there's really no perfect way to do it. But those who got childhood diseases usually have lifetime immunity. Yeah. That's not true for the vaccinations. You know, you used to have to have a booster.
Right. So let me ask you, so you said they would expose you to measles, and what was the other one, mumps too? And how would they expose you? Like you would
they put you around children that had it.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Right.
Yeah, in my family there were six children. So if one of us got something, the other children were allowed to associate.
Yeah.
You know, because the idea was, let's get it over with.
Yeah. So have you heard that there's this thing right now called pox parties, where same thing, but with chicken pox, right? You know, because I don't know how long they've had the chicken pox vaccine, but it's ridiculous, right? Because it's basically a harmless viral infection that most often affects kids. But if a person gets it as an adult, it becomes shingles, and it's much more painful, and it's much more severe. And so you just like those things, you'd want to get it as a child. And so, so there's Facebook groups and different things like that of people who say, all right, does anybody know, you know, and then people taking pictures of their kid, like one bump, is this chicken pox? And then everyone's like, where do you live? I'm coming now. So it's natural immunity. I mean, you know, so you get immunity from the breast milk, right? But then, you know, if you get the actual disease as a child, you know, kids are so much more resilient, and they can bounce back so much quicker than an adult. And so it just seems like getting these diseases as a child, like, why would you not want to do that? And so the other thing is I want to say about vaccines is, you know, people like to, you know, just categorize, you know, pro-vaxxers or anti-vaxxers, right? But also what irritates me is that just in the same way as I don't know what a free market in medications and pharmaceuticals looks like because we don't have one, the same thing with vaccines. I don't know what a free market in vaccines. What would a vaccine look like if it was developed by the free market without state influence? I have no idea.
Well, you know, you would have choice, of course, whether or not to take it. Really good part is.
there would be choice, but what I'm saying is, I don't think they would be able to make such a product that would harm people, you know, so easily, because they would simply just, you know, word would spread and they'd go out of business. So I'm saying
it'd probably be just for like major diseases, you know.
Perhaps,
for example, I don't know that there would be one for mumps or chicken pox. I mean, I think
or the flu.
Yeah, or the flu. Well, the flu vaccine is really nuts because even in the best years, it only prevents about 10% of. And the reason is it's made for a particular strain, and the strain, you know, these strains mutate. There's multiple strains.
Yeah.
So, and actually, I knew a serviceman who said that they insisted that they get the flu shot, and every time he got the flu shot, he got the flu. And he kept trying to tell them that, and they kept saying, no, you're trying to malinger, you know, you're just trying to work.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's very interesting how there seems to be an acknowledgement among medical professionals that drugs have side effects, but they don't seem to think that vaccines have side effects. And if they know any of their biology, they know that a vaccine has more potential to have a side effect because it's biological material. So I don't understand how our medical profession seems to totally ignore the dangers of vaccine and the dangers of so many vaccines in a short period of time.
Yeah, I remember hearing somebody say that, I think it was the health ranger, he said, from naturalnews.com, Mike Adams, the health ranger, and he said the flu vaccine is only good for time travelers. So the reason is because basically they're guessing what strain will affect the population in the flu season. They have no idea, right? Just a crapshoot, you know, just a guess. And so, you know, only a person who already been to the future, it's this strain. Oh, now we know which strain to give. Go ahead.
Oh, another good vaccine story is that, so, you know, of course, one of the big uses of vaccines is when we deploy troops overseas, we tend to
yeah.
bunch of vaccines, right? And in that case, where they're going oftentimes is pretty dangerous in terms of diseases. So that kind of makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there was a case where a different company bought the vaccine from another company and set up the manufacturing, and it wanted to distribute these vaccines to the troops going overseas, but the FDA wouldn't let them do that until the manufacturing facility had been tested. But it was the sole source of, I can't remember which vaccine it was, a particular vaccine.
Mm.
So basically, our troops went over without that vaccine because the FDA hadn't yet approved the manufacturing, even though everything was the same. So it's kind of nutty how all these vaccines seem to be quickly approved, except the ones that we might actually need for our troops, you know,
right.
where people are actually going in harm's way and could really use the vaccine. So I find that strange. But, you know, actually, this isn't the only instance. This year, the Department of Defense put in their budget that they, the Department of Defense, wanted to be able to approve drugs that are going to be used on the battlefield and take that power away from the FDA. And the reason they wanted to do that is the FDA has been dragging their feet on the approval of plasma in plastic bags for battlefield use.
Hmm.
So what the DOD is doing is they are buying plasma in glass containers from France to use on the battlefield. Now, can you think of a situation that's more dangerous than that for these poor glass bottles? And they're heavy.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're a medic trying to treat people on the battlefield, how many of these glass containers can you take? And will they be intact when
right.
you get to the person you're using them on? Well, that budget didn't pass that way. There was a compromise. Basically, the FDA said, well, we'll talk to you about it. Because they were saying it's going to be 2 years before this plasma and plastic bags will be approved. And this has been going on for years, which is why the DOD finally put it in their budget that they wanted to be able to approve these drugs. So it's not just the American public that's upset with the timeline for approval. It's even other government agencies, and you can see why.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing.
The
Department of Defense is complaining about the FDA.
Yeah, and I mean, come on, you know. I mean, our troops, when they're wounded on the battlefield, they don't have much of a chance anyhow, but plasma could really make a difference. And to not approve it in the plastic bags, it's mind-boggling. You know, what possible harm could there be that, you know, compared to not having that plasma? Because that's really the option, not having the plasma, because they can't carry it enough, and what they can carry is likely to get destroyed before it gets to the soldiers that need it. So it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, yeah. That's how long has the FDA been around? When was it created?
Yeah, in the early 1900s, and then in 1938, there was a safety problem that gave it a little more power. And enough power to say, hey, unless you do safety testing, you can't put the drug on the market.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the 1962 amendments, it wasn't just safety, it was also effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't just that. It gave the FDA the power to dictate which animal studies had to be done before human trials, which human trials had to be done, what manufacturing standards had to happen, and what advertising and that the companies could use. So when I say and show in Death by Regulation that the prices that we pay at the pharmacy are directly related to the research and development costs, which are going up exponentially every year because of the FDA, this is a surrogate, or how can I say it? It's not just the R&D that's going up. It's the manufacturing requirements that are going up. It's the advertising requirements that are going up. In other words, all parts of the drug industry were affected by these amendments, even probably the profit. And I say that because if you think about it, as as the cost of development gets higher, it gets riskier and riskier to try to develop a drug.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're going to lose a lot of money if you sink in a couple billion dollars and you don't get an approval, right?
Right, right.
So if you have to wait long, 13 years or so to get your return, investors are going to want a lot of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't have that profit to turn over to their investors, they won't have enough money in order to do drug development at all. So basically the entire industry is driven by these regulations and the costs are driven. And that's something most people, of course, don't understand. They don't realize that basically companies have to turn every ad that they want to do, every package insert over to the FDA. And if the FDA doesn't like it, you'll go back and forth for quite a while, which is very expensive. And so that even the advertising bill that we see for the drug companies is influenced by these regulations. It's greatly increased compared to what other companies have to use. So, again, unless you're in the industry, you don't know this. There's no reason that consumers would have a clue.
There's a movement, I'm sure you're aware of that, of doctors that are like completely bypassing insurance and
mm-hmm.
just catering directly to the patient.
And that's right.
In that way, they can drastically reduce their price. And mm-hmm. also, are you familiar with this guy, Josh Umber?
I don't think so, no.
Tom Woods interviewed him. He's a physician, and he does that. And he also sells his medications directly to the patient, I think, at like 97% decrease in price as compared to, what you would get if they would go, the other regular route. Which is amazing.
That is amazing. I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah.
There's doctors that have lower prices. I did an interview with Health Excellence Plus, and what they do is they have something. It's not quite insurance. It's more like I'm not sure what to call it actually. But you pay a monthly premium, and
like a pool, like a health pool.
Yeah,
of people.
Some kind of health pool, right? And the beauty of it is what they do is they find these doctors that are not charging for insurance, so.
Yeah.
So in other words, their costs are very low, and that's true for like imaging and radiological testing and things like this. So they send their patients to, people who give them a much better price. And I think that's wonderful. It used to be that if doctors advertised how much they charge, that the medical licensing boards would take their license away. So that's why they didn't do that. I don't know how they've been getting around that now, but I guess they don't dare do that anymore, take a person's license away because they're letting people know what their costs are.
And I thought, isn't another reason that the prices for going to doctors and their treatments is so astronomical is because of all of the requirements that they have to reach to become a licensed
right.
physician. Like all
That's
the
right.
years of college and the student loan debt. And all that also factors in, right, to the price.
Yes. Oh, yes. In fact, and this isn't, just hearsay. I mean, the Journal of the American Medical Association in, I think it was the 1930s, basically had put a call out for professional birth control, which meant they wanted to limit the number of doctors so the salaries would go up. And they did that.
Wow.
And the per capita ratio of doctors to patients, was really lowered by that and didn't really come back, I think, in, I don't recall the exact year, but it was, I think, in the 60s, possibly even the 70s. And, of course, but now we have so much more that a doctor can do for you that still basically was a shortage, of
yeah.
medical practitioners.
Yeah.
And it used to be that nurses, there were no such thing as nurse practitioners back when I was younger. This was a relatively new development because there just weren't enough physicians to go around, and there still aren't. And that's why we're bringing physicians in from other countries. And it's totally unnecessary. There's so many people who want to go to medical school and are willing to pay the high prices, but they limit the number of attendees, so they limit the number of doctors too.
Oh, yeah, and that's so sad. And, in the end, the consumer suffers. The consumer pays,
Well, exactly. And this is another thing about certification. In places where they have certification instead of licensing, they have more quality service delivered. For example, if you look at the different states and you look at the requirements for electricians, there are more accidental electrocutions in states that have high requirements for their electricians. And the reason is the harder it is for an electrician to get that license, the fewer electricians there will be and the higher prices they charge.
Yeah.
So then if you're not so well off financially, you think, well, maybe I can do this repair.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you think, well, I can't afford the repair.
Right.
So, of course, what ends up happening in those cases, the people who can't afford an electrician are the ones that get accidentally electrocuted.
Mm.
Now, when they use certification, this changes. And this is true for dental hygiene, in areas where – and optometrists, too. There's more blindness when the requirements for an optometrist are greater.
Hmm.
I mean, so the bottom line is regulation decreases the amount of quality service delivered, whereas certification – in states that had certification for some of these things – not only did they have more service, but it was a much lower price. So more quality service got delivered. So it's really – certification is really the way to go. And this is – this has pretty well been tested, I think, in areas where you can see that it's a matter of life and death. So it's something we really need to consider doing.
Yeah, and I know, a good amount of people, usually the older generation, that have this diehard – loyalty to doctors. Like, these people are doctors. They know what they're doing. It's not easy to become a doctor. Whereas most of the time, it's like you said, maybe somebody doesn't have the money. Maybe they are smart. They just don't have the money, or the ability to go to medical school. But it doesn't mean they're not smart. And if there wasn't these high barriers to entry, how many more doctors would be available? How low would the price be? How high would the quality be? It's just so sad to see that that bottleneck,
Yes, and a lot of alternative practitioners have been run out of business. In fact, the chiropractors almost were run out of business, and they instituted an antitrust suit against the American Medical Association because basically the American Medical Association was telling physicians, hey, if you recommend a chiropractor, if you work with a chiropractor, if you have anything to do with a chiropractor, we're going to take your license away.
Wow.
And so basically the chiropractors won that suit, and I'm so glad because I've needed chiropractic services for most of my adult life, and without them I wouldn't – I'm not sure I'd be doing everything I do.
Yeah, as we wrap up, let me just ask you one question that I know a lot of people are thinking of, about, which is, how do you have all this energy?
Well, I don't think of myself as very energetic, actually. But, I think when you're doing something you love, and I really loved my work in the sciences, and I love my work with the libertarians, and so I've been very blessed to be able to do work that I really love. And I think when that happens, it's easy or easier to, really get involved and stay involved and do what's necessary to get your projects done.
Yes, have a purpose, have a goal in life. What's the reason that you wake up in the morning? Is it just to have your cup of coffee and check your Facebook, or do you have a more passionate reason to wake up? And yes, it's so true. That's really what drives anyone, when you hear about people who, they stop, or let's say they retire, and then, they don't have any purpose anymore, no reason, and that's really the major killer. It's not a heart attack, it's not a stroke, it seems like it's lack of purpose to me.
Even older people, that still are working sometimes get that. I noticed that, in all of my jobs, is that there was a subset of people who you could see we're already discouraged with their jobs, weren't happy there. Yeah. And I feel very blessed that, I for the most part had really good people to report to and people who were supportive and people who helped me, people that were in my laboratory and reporting to me were so helpful and good people. I feel very blessed. I've had wonderful people to work with because that makes a big difference too.
Yeah. I remember learning about this program where people in nursing homes in, I think, the United States would regularly, you know, do a Skype call with someone from South America, and what the reason they did that was because the person from South America was learning English and they needed somebody to practice with. And so these older people in nursing homes were very often abandoned by their family that, you know, maybe would come to visit them once every few weeks or a month or something. But for the most part, they're just alone and nobody to talk to. And now they have a reason to talk to these young people. And it's such a wonderful thing. And it gives them such joy.
Well, Skype is a wonderful thing. Yes, Skype is a wonderful thing. And, of course, one of the things I guess I should say that I've been blessed with also is I've had cats all my life. And when I have to write, and I kind of tend to be cloistered when I write, I have my little companions. And, you know, that makes a difference, too. As I said, I've just been very fortunate because a lot of people work very hard and they don't have what I would consider the best of colleagues working with them.
Right.
And that can be very discouraging. So, you know, if someone's in that situation, I usually try to encourage them to go elsewhere because, you know, there are a lot of appreciative bosses. There are a lot of situations where you can work and actually have a lot of camaraderie. But sometimes you have to hunt for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's highly unlikely that your first job at McDonald's is going to be your spiritually fulfilling career, but we all start somewhere, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I used to wait on tables, and I actually kind of liked it because, you know, these people would come in, and these couples usually, and they weren't doing much talking. They didn't have smiles on their faces, and I figured, well, hey, I can come there with a smile, and I can chit chat with them, and take their order, and serve them well, and you know, give them a little lift, and that was very fulfilling, actually. You know, that was a good way to start out my paid career, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's one of the excellent jobs to illustrate the awesome incentives of the free market, which is I don't necessarily know you, but if I treat you well, then I get paid. So if you're happy, then I get paid. So that's a win-win.
Yes. And of course, there's also just the enjoyment of putting a smile on someone's face.
Well, that's, you know? Yeah, that's wonderful too.
I mean, that most people enjoy that, and I certainly did. And you know, there's a lot of life can be very harsh. So helping each other have a good moment is very worthwhile.
Yeah, and that definitely you know, it makes sense when you wrote your book later, which is was a Healing the World, the Compassion of Libertarianism. I mean, completely. that's the embodiment of your philosophy, which is, you know, we're here to make each other smile and laugh and enjoy life while we have it.
Well, that's right, you know, because when we work together, we can create so much more for everybody. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, that's why, you know, there are libertarians who talk about going off in the woods and being by themselves so that they don't have to worry about the impact of other people, including government. And that's fine, I guess, if you want to do that. But I think really the big challenge and the big excitement in my mind is working with other people, because when you have other people working with you, you can do so much more, you know. Mm-hmm. In other words, mm-hmm. 2 + 2 can equal 6 or 8 or 10 in terms of product, you know, and that's very exciting too.
Yeah. The sum is greater than the individual parts, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Wonderful conversation, Mary. I'm really happy we did this. So before you go, please reiterate your contact information if anybody wants to reach you.
Sure. Well, the best source is to go to my website, ruart.com, ruart.com. And you can, on the very front page, you can see a link to my Facebook page, LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, all that stuff. So you can go directly there. I have a lot of free stuff on my website, for you to enjoy, including videos, audios, and actually the 1993 version of Healing Our World. And of course, there you can also purchase the 2015 edition of Healing Our World. There's some short answers to the tough questions for free. And of course, you can get the new expanded short answers version there, and Death by Regulation. All those are also available on Amazon, and you can also get electronic copy either at my website or on Amazon. So there's a lot there, and I hope you'll enjoy. And you can also contact me at my website. In fact, that's the best way to do it. I get so many emails, but I get little flags when you do it through my website. So I always answer my email. So if you don't hear from me, try again.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Save. And if anything, if you're feeling down, just contact Mary. I'm sure she'll put a smile on your face. So. As she tends to do. So I know I asked you the last time we talked, but maybe your quote is different this time. What is your favorite quote of all time?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, of course, right now, having just written Death by Regulation, I have to say Dale Greninger's quote about the FDA comes to mind.
Okay.
And that is that the FDA regulations certainly cannot be proven safe and effective, so the FDA flunks its own criteria.
I like that. Very good. Self-defeating institution.
Well, again, I think a lot of them kind of realize what the situation is, but the politics, of course, is, you know, it's incentives in the wrong direction.
Yes.
Politics.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the state itself is an incentive in the wrong direction.
Yeah. That's very good. A good quote. Yeah, yeah. That's a good quote, too.
Yeah. The personification of the state. Well, yeah, but yeah. Awesome conversation, Mary. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. So, everybody, please pick up her book, Death by Regulation. It was on the bestseller list a few days. Maybe we can get it back on there. That would be awesome.
Yep. On Amazon.
yes. Please, purchase her book. Check it out. Check out her videos, her website. So thank you very much, Mary. I really appreciate it. So this is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on the Seeds of Liberty podcast and theconsciousresistance.com. Wishing all of you have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this content and would like to see more of it, please feel free to donate and help me interview other fascinating people. You can do so through Patreon. That's patreon.com/peacefulanarchism to help me out. $1 a show is all I ask. If you feel so inclined to donate more, please feel free. It will only assist me in spreading the message of freedom and voluntarism that much farther and that much more efficiently. You can also donate to my Bitcoin. My Bitcoin address is in the description to my videos as well as on my website, peacefulanarchism.com. And while you're on my site, there's a donate button to donate through PayPal. If you prefer to donate through PayPal, you can do so with that. But Patreon is a little bit easier for content creators, as you can set up a recurring donation if you so desire. Also, while you're on my website, peacefulanarchism.com, please feel free to sign up, enter your email address, sign up for my newsletter, and you'll receive updates every time I post something, a video or an interview. I do not send out any spam. Or you can also follow me on Facebook, under facebook.com/peacefulanarchism or facebook.com/DaniloCuellar3, I believe. DaniloCuellar3. So either one of those methods, if you are able to donate, I would be most appreciative. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a magnificent day.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT no government license. Cell 411, because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.